Well, greetings everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour and Editorial Review. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. I'm your narrator, George Gordon. The Law Hour and Editorial Review is heard nationally and internationally 7 days a week here in the United States and in more than 120 countries worldwide over the Internet. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and Editorial Review, please visit our webpage at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour and Editorial Review brings you important information about law, science, education, politics, religion, health, history, economics, news, and current events. So stay tuned for tonight's special report on insurance is a crime, right after this. You know, the lessons on courtroom strategy and procedure that you hear on this program are just a small part of our two-week basic courtroom strategy and procedure school. And this school includes lessons on what to do and what not to do at the scene of any alleged crime. What should you say to the police or to investigators, and what you ought not to say to the police. And you'll learn how to conduct yourself in your case at bail setting, arraignment, pleadings, motion hearings, trial, and appeal. And you'll learn how to ask questions, cross-examine adverse witnesses, select a jury, introduce exhibits and evidence, conduct discovery, do legal research, and follow the rules of court. Now, there are 28 things you need to know, 28 elements to learn in courtroom strategy and procedure, and rule one is that all of the evidence that your opponent is ever going to use against you is going to be furnished by you. So keep your mouth shut, don't say anything, and then shut up. Now, after rule one is out of the way, we can get to the real business of winning your case. Now, if you'd like more information about courtroom strategy and procedure, why don't you call us here at the law school? The number is 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, be sure to ask for our free general law CD package. That's a four-hour commentary on the law school. It's entertaining, it's educational, it's informative, and it's free of charge. Now, courtroom strategy and procedure, our school, is available on compact disc for adult home education. If you're online, you can go to our website, georgegordon.org. Again, this is georgegordon.org. Just click on the email and send us an email request for that free general law CD package. Once more, that's georgegordon.org, or you can call us direct at 417-273-4967. Why don't you do it right now before you forget? All right, we're talking about insurance. Insurance. You know, the stuff that everybody has to buy whether you want it or not. In fact, most people want it. It isn't something, you know, that's being forced on you. Well, with the exception of auto insurance. Now, auto insurance is a little bit different breed of cat here. They came along here back in the 1980s in most of the states, and the insurance companies got together with the legislatures, and they said, hey, we need auto insurance because there's so many uninsured drivers out there. And I came up with a thing here called no-fault insurance, no-fault auto insurance. Did you think up no-fault auto insurance and go to your legislature and say, I got a better idea than tort claim insurance? I've got a no-fault plan. Did that come from you? No, it didn't come from me either. It came from the insurance industry. And auto insurance company profits are greater under no fault than under tort claim insurance. They're the ones that thunk it up, and they're the ones that went into the legislatures and got it passed. Just like mandatory insurance. They're the ones that thunk it up, and they're the ones that got it passed. Wasn't you, wasn't me. It was imposed upon us. And this isn't a marketplace decision either. If it was a marketplace decision, you probably wouldn't have insurance. But it isn't a marketplace decision. It's enforced upon you against your will and over your objection, whether you want it or not. It's the law. And, you know, the first thing the policeman asks for is your driver's license, registration, and proof of insurance. Got to have your papers in order here, you know. Now, the policeman is an enforcer. He works for the insurance industry. That's the bottom line. If you want to know where all the auto regulations come from, I mean, you got 2,000 statutes in your state's auto regulations or automobile laws. And those 2,000 regulations are all of them promoted by the insurance industry. And every one of those laws is designed to protect the claims window of the insurance industry. It has nothing to do with the health, the safety, or the welfare of the motoring public. Nothing, nothing, nothing to do with that. That's the guise, that's the ruse that's used to enact these laws, because that's what the Constitution requires. So, we have to have a reason why we do something. Let me give you an illustration of one of these ruses. Here in Springfield recently, over the last 3 or 4 years, they started putting up cameras at the busy intersections, and they take your picture if you run the red light. Now, at first blush, when I say run the red light, you say, well, by God, we need somebody out there to protect us from these red light runners. And I wouldn't disagree with that. Who wants to be driving down the street and people just deciding for themselves, well, the light's red, but I don't think I'll stop. I think I'll just keep right on going. Especially at the busy intersections, you see. Now, that could be very, very hazardous to your health. So, what they do is they put this camera up, and then you and I and everybody else, when we're approaching this traffic light, from time to time, if you'll notice, as you're driving up to the light, you're traveling at 35 miles an hour. Just picture yourself now in the car, and you're driving up here, and you're 35 miles an hour. Your light's green, see? And you can see that the traffic is stopped in both directions opposite you, see? I mean, on your right and on your left, the traffic is stopped, and you're a block away, and you're looking ahead, and the light's green. But as you're approaching the traffic light, your light turns from green to yellow. Now you have to make a decision. Should I slam on the brakes and throw the kid into the windshield and bloody his nose, or should I step on the gas and get through the intersection? You know, it's a choice that you have to make every time you approach one of these lights. Every one of us has to make that decision every time you get there. So on a trip to Springfield, you got to do that probably 5 or 10 times, you know, in the course of the day. Now, of course, we're all aware that it's against the law to run a red light. Now, what's running a red light? Let's picture this. Now, as you're approaching the intersection, now the light has turned yellow, and just as the bumper of your car at 35 miles an hour reaches the first line of the crosswalk where you would normally stop, see? But now you're not stopped. You're going 35 miles an hour, and the light now changes from yellow to red. Okay. Now, the camera takes the picture of your car running the red light. The light's red, Bob. Okay. You're traveling 35 miles an hour, and the light turned red just as your front bumper came upon the first white line of the crosswalk. Now, from your experience in life, how many traffic accidents have you observed or heard of occurring in that circumstance? Now, mull that one over now for a second now as we're thinking about this. And the answer is exactly zero. It's impossible to have an auto accident at that intersection under those circumstances. And every traffic engineer knows that. And every one of you knows that. And that's simple. You don't have to even be smart to figure this out. The traffic that's coming from your right and left are already stopped. Hell, they've been stopped for a minute or two. And furthermore, in Springfield here, when the light turns red for you, it remains red for the other direction for about 1 or 2 seconds. The lights are red for everybody for about 2 seconds. Then the light turns green. Now, at 35 miles an hour, when your bumper reaches that first white line, how long does it take you to go through that intersection? Well, not over 2 seconds. Now, nobody has ever been injured, killed, or had an auto accident under that circumstance. But if you get picked up on this new camera, this new traffic control device over here, they send you a ticket in the mail for $100 plus $35 court cost. So they take $130. It's $135 tax is what that is. That doesn't have anything to do with health, safety, and welfare of the public any more than compulsory insurance has anything to do with health, safety, and welfare of the public. Now, I pointed this out to you the other day. If you have an auto accident and the amount of money that's involved is $25,000 to $100,000, your chances of getting paid is 56%, and 44% of you will not get paid. Period. End of report. If your claim is $100,000 or more, your chances of getting paid are 9%. 9%. And 91 of you will not get paid. Period. And that's the end of that report. So if you thought that the auto insurance companies were coming up with a new idea for compulsory mandatory auto insurance, so that everybody is adequately covered, so that when events transpire, there will be money in the pool to pay for all these damages, you got your head up the wrong end again, Bob. Because that's not the purpose. Auto insurance companies are in business to make profit and gain. And they go to the legislatures to get the laws passed that they want passed. They write them. They lobby for them. And then they use them for their own profit. Nothing more and nothing less. Now, if you think the idea of insurance is good, then you got your head up the wrong end again, because the creator of the universe said, no, that's a bad plan. Limited liability is a bad plan. Strict liability is the program you should be following, and that's the law. That's the law of God. That's the creator. He came along, he said, hey, this is the way this game's got to be played. We're the people that came along and said, oh, no, God, you don't understand. You got this backwards again, you dummy. Go off on back to heaven and mind your own business and let us take care of trade, commerce, business, and industry. So he did. He's very accommodating. So he's butted out, and he's let you do your thing. And so this is the results that you get. Now they've expanded this. Now they got a thing here called health insurance. Health insurance. And up in Massachusetts, that's the first state, the pilot state, that's passed this compulsory health insurance program. And now if you don't have health insurance in Massachusetts, they fine you $900. $900. God, I'm glad I don't live in Massachusetts. But they want to do that everywhere. And our new president wants compulsory insurance, and he or something like it. I'm not quite sure what he's in favor of or not, but Hillary Clinton, back in the early Clinton years, they wanted to get a health insurance program passed, just like all you Canadians and Australians have, and you Englishmen out there. After all, the advanced Western social democracies over here, you know, we got to keep up with the Joneses, and so they've come up with this new idea, and I don't doubt as time progresses along, they're going to come up with a compulsory health insurance program. But if you think that that's because anybody is concerned about your health and your hospital bills, again, you get your head up the wrong end. Insurance companies are profit-making institutions, just like banks and pharmaceutical companies. They're there to make money. And the best way to make money is to have the laws enacted to compel you to buy their products, or at least to encourage you to buy their products and to dissuade you from buying somebody else's. And that's what we have in the drug industry. The three big industries in America now are insurance, drugs, and banking. Those are the three big industries. And companies like Novartis and Pfizer and Merck, you know, your local Rexall store over here, they are operated by boardroom hoodlums, as opposed to the street corner hoodlums. But they're both selling the same product. They're selling drugs. And the street corner hoodlums have the edge because they can sell cocaine, heroin, and marijuana cheaper than the boardroom hoodlums from Novartis, Pfizer, and Merck by about half. Now, somebody's going to say, well, you know, Novartis, they don't sell crack cocaine and heroin and marijuana. Oh, yeah, they do. Oh, yeah, they do. They just don't call it by those names. They have different names for their product line, copyrighted and trademarked names. You know, you want to buy heroin, they've got a trademark name for that. And the battle isn't over drugs versus no drugs. The battle is, and everybody's in sync with this. We all want drugs, like we all want insurance. And the question is, who's going to sell it? Who gets the market? And so the street hoodlums say, well, we're going to horn in on Novartis and Pfizer and Merck and Rexall. We're going to horn in and we're going to sell our products. And then we have to have a war on drugs. And so the boardroom hoodlums, they go to the legislature and they use the police power of the state to keep the street corner hoodlums off their corners, get their products off the streets, out of the marketplace. That's all we're dealing with here. Well, the insurance companies do the same thing, but they're more sophisticated at it. See, they walk in to the legislatures and the Congress, and they get the laws passed that they want. And then they get the policemen out here, the police power of the state, to come out here and enforce it. How's that for a plan? Now, I mentioned this the other day. I said, we got a protection racket in New York. I suppose you have it in other places as well, but at least in New York, you got this protection racket, and this is where Luigi comes into your store, and he says, hey, you need protection. You need protection from fire. You need protection from this and that and another thing, and I can provide it. And if you don't buy it for $100 a week, well, your store is going to burn down. Just like that delicatessen up the street. He didn't have insurance. Hey, he didn't have protection. Hey, his store burned down. Pay the $100 a week, your store doesn't burn down. If you don't pay the $100 a week, I guarantee your store is going to burn down. I promise you. So you pay the protection money. Now we know that that's a crime. We know that that's extortion. But when the insurance industry comes along and the policeman comes out there and says, where's your insurance card? We don't call that extortion now, do we? We call it law and order. Well, you know, you can hang whatever label on there you want, but you know, when the policeman is demanding your insurance card over here and he's going to give you a ticket and do something bad, wicked, terrible, awful, and evil to you if he doesn't get it and take your license away, can take your car away, can put you in jail, going to fine you. That's extortion. Nothing more, nothing less. That's not a free market decision on your part. Now, there was a time in America when people chose for themselves whether or not they wanted to buy insurance, whether they wanted to buy health insurance, whether they want to participate in this program. But we don't have that now. We have a fascist government, and the fascist government working with industry, private industry and government working together. Now, that's fascism. That's Mussolini and Hitler and their program. And we just call that law and order, and we live with it, whether we like it or not. You know, the world doesn't come to an end just because we've got a fascist government. But I wanted to point out that it's not something that you got from God, even though your local preacher over here is probably advising you that you ought to participate in these kinds of criminal activities. I thought I'd bring it to your attention. There's no such thing as a broken law without a penalty. So I pointed out to you that this insurance violates the strict liability statute of Exodus 21, 28 through 36. And there's no such thing as a broken law without a penalty. Now, the average Joe Sixpack thinks that insurance is good and it pays off. And I pointed out to you, well, it doesn't pay off. And you people down on the Gulf Coast who had hurricane insurance, you know it doesn't pay off. But now if you want to rebuild your house, you go to the bank to get a mortgage to rebuild your house, and the bank says you have to buy hurricane insurance. Help, you just had hurricane insurance that didn't pay. Why do you need to buy more hurricane insurance that didn't pay you the last time? Did you think it was going to pay you the next time? So the banks are in cahoots now with the insurance industry. That's all. I don't know how their payoff works. I don't know what their system is. But when the bank insists upon you having hurricane insurance that you've already had in the past and it didn't pay off in the past, because your house in a hurricane is about 90% of the time it's going to be damaged by water, and the hurricane policy specifically excludes water damage. You got to have flood insurance to do that. It's two different policies. And so this insurance salesman comes along, he sells you a hurricane policy. Well, of course you need a hurricane policy. You live in Biloxi, Mississippi, but they ain't going to pay off unless the wind blows your house down. If the wind blows your house down, that's fine. Here in Tornado Alley, people buy tornado insurance. And if your house is blown down by straight-line winds, they will not pay you. Now, I want to ask you, what in the hell difference does it make to you whether a circular wind blows your house down or a straight-line wind blows your house down? Isn't it just as destroyed either way? But they don't call it straight-line insurance, straight-line wind insurance. They call it tornado insurance. All right. So, bottom line is, the reason that we write these policies the way we do, and the reason that we conduct our business the way we do, is to take your premiums, and then if there is an event, we don't want to pay you. And so we're very careful to write this up in the contract so that there is a but-sept exception for the insurance company so they don't have to pay off on the claim. Now, that's the way that game is played. Now, let me tell you a story over here. I had an old buddy one time. His name is Emil Crow. And Emil is an insurance adjuster. He's a private insurance adjuster. And that means that he works for any insurance company that wants to hire him to go out and investigate a claim. And so one time, he's working the southern tier of counties here in Missouri back in 1950. That's from Joplin, Missouri, over to the Boot Heel, southern tier of counties, those counties that border on Arkansas, northern Arkansas. And the Travelers Insurance Company calls him one day and says, hey, one of our policyholders had a wreck, and we want you to investigate this wreck. And he's got a $50,000 policy. Now, that was unusual, because in 1950, a $50,000 policy would be like having a $500,000 policy today, maybe more. Now, normal policies would be $5,000 or $10,000. Maybe if it was a big policy, it might be $10,000 to $20,000. But to have a $50,000 auto insurance policy in 1950, that's big news. All right, but anyway, the guy's got a $50,000 policy, so we're talking about big bucks for 1950. And Emil goes out, investigates, and finds out, sure enough, our policy holder is guilty as hell. He caused all the damage, and furthermore, it's worse than that. It's worse than that. If this case goes to trial, $50,000 probably ain't going to cover the damages. It's probably going to amount to more like $60,000, $70,000, maybe even $80,000. And now the insurance company doesn't care if it costs $80,000. That's not their worry in life. Their policy limits $50,000. That's all they're ever going to pay out. But see, they've got a duty here to defend their insured. So they got to go to court. They got to hire the defense counsel, and they've got to go litigate this. And this litigation might take you clear to the U.S. Supreme Court. Now, in today's dollars, if the insurance company had to litigate clear to the U.S. Supreme Court, it cost them about $250,000. So in 1950 dollars, probably the number would be around $25,000, or about half the value of the policy would be wrapped up in litigation. So, listen, the last thing that we want is litigation. I mean, the insurance company doesn't want to have to go to court and litigate this. They're probably going to lose, probably. You know, statistically, they'd look at that and say, well, the numbers tell us we're going to lose, so we want to settle this out of court. How does the insurance adjuster get paid? What's their deal with Emil Crow? What's the story there? Well, when I was in the insurance adjusting business, you had two ways to do it. You could be a freelance insurance, that is a contractor, or you could work for the company. Now, if you work for the company, you get paid by the hour. You get a salary. You get paid by the month. Well, you know, there's a modality for that. But if you're a freelance insurance adjuster, that is, you'll go out and adjust whatever claim you have. Travelers didn't have very much business in this Boot Heel area, and so because of that, they don't have a claims adjuster on staff, you know, say in Joplin, Missouri, or over in the Boot Heel or something like that. So they hired Emil. So Emil's going to get paid, he's going to get paid a percentage of what he saves the Travelers Insurance Company. So the percentage is 50%. That's pretty lucrative, and it's designed that way. You see, an insurance agent gets paid 50% of the initial sale. So he sells you an insurance policy, and let's say the insurance policy is $500 a year. So by selling it to you, he gets $250, and the insurance company gets $250. If you renew the policy next year, he gets 5% of the $250, or $25. And that goes on as long as he's selling the policy, or as long as you renew the policy and keep it. Now, on the other hand, if you're an insurance adjuster and you've got a claim here, the first thing we got to do is to establish the value of the claim. So Emil went out and said, well, it's a $50,000 claim. The guy put several people in the hospital. Nobody died. No deaths involved here. But they got banged up pretty bad. And then the property damage and the hospital bills were going to total out that $50,000. Lost wages, you know, one thing or another. And we don't know how much more than that, but they figured, you know, hell, if this thing goes to trial, you know, juries, you know, are kind of capricious people, and they might award this guy $60,000 or $70,000 or $80,000. So we need to figure that we're going to lose the whole 50 plus litigation. All right, so Emil goes into the hospital, visits this guy, tells him he's in safe hands with the Travelers Insurance. You know, we're going to take care of everything. And so some time goes by. Time goes by. In fact, about 60 days goes by. This guy is still in the hospital for 60 days. I mean, he's banged up pretty bad. And Emil comes in one day and he says, now listen, we want to settle this claim, and I'm authorized to settle this claim today. I can write you the check. Now, we think that there's a thing here called contributory negligence. That is, we don't think that our insured is 100% liable for all of the damages. We think that you have some responsibility here in this accident. Now, we concede that we have some liability here. We have some fault. But we just contend that we don't have all the fault. See? And so we're going to offer you $7,000. Now, here's a guy, he's damaged $50,000, and you offer him $7,000. And naturally, he's bummed out. This is what we call a nuisance value settlement. And he gets mad. He says, get the hell out of here while you can still walk. I may be crippled up here and hurt, but I'm going to get real mean here if you don't get the hell out of here. I'm going to hire a lawyer, and we're going to sue you. So he does. He hires an attorney. And that's exactly what Emil wanted. See, Emil not only is a claims adjuster, he's also a licensed attorney. And, you know, the attorney does not want to deal with you. He wants to deal with another shark like himself, you know. So he welcomes the opportunity to deal with your attorney. So the two attorneys sit down, Emil and this guy's attorney. They sit down, and Emil tells this guy, now I want you to understand one more factor. The insurance company will guard the policy limit with their lives. If there's one thing that you cannot know on discovery in an accident case like we're discussing here, you cannot know how much you're playing for. You cannot know what the parameters of the game are. So the other side cannot know that the policy limit's $50,000. So Emil tells them that it's $20,000. What you're playing for here is $20,000. But you can't have the whole $20,000 because Emil, the insurance adjuster, has to be paid half of what he saves the company. If they pay out the whole $50,000, Emil gets zero. If Emil settles the case for $25,000, Emil gets $12,500, the insurance company saves $12,500, and the victim gets $25,000. That's the way that thing's going to be divided up. Emil offered $7,000. If the guy accepts, there's $43,000 on the table. Emil gets half of $43,000, Travelers gets the other half, and the victim gets $7,000. And so Emil tells this guy's attorney, he says, "You're playing for $20,000." And that guy has no way of knowing. In fact, it's protected by law. Test it. Try it. Go ahead. Ask on discovery. What's the policy limit? And you'll find out. You can't know. All right. Now, we'll be back and talk a little more about that as we progress along. But I got to give you a reminder here that you're listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review. And we're sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, the Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States, and we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. If you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website at georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. Now, the Law School teaches family law, tax law, courtroom strategy and procedure, business law, agricultural law, civil rights, and biblical law from the scriptural perspective. Now, it's 8 schools in all. The law school is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The law school conducts a homeschooling program for adults on compact disc. The Law Hour website is updated weekly. It has a radio log schedule and archives, all of which can be accessed through our webpage at georgegordon.org. Now, all of these Law Hour programs are archived on the Internet by title and date for your listening convenience, and the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. The Law School offers a free 4-hour introductory CD package. Be sure to order yours by calling the Law School at 417-273-4967. Again, that's area code 417-273-4967. Now, the sources of information that we use on this program are true, accurate, and correct to the best of our knowledge and belief, and the Law Hour and editorial review gives credit to those authors and publications that we use on this program. And we often endorse or recommend books, papers, periodicals, and newsletters to our listeners. Now, these endorsements or recommendations that we give out don't mean that the authors or publications that we endorse are necessarily going to reciprocate. We should keep in mind that most of these authors and publications cited here on the Law Hour may be hostile, political, religious, economic, sectarian, racial, or ethnic partisans, and their viewpoint may not be totally endorsed by the Law Hour and editorial review. Now, these opinions, beliefs, comments, views, and expressions that you hear on this program are mine. They're mine alone. They do not necessarily represent the views, beliefs, or the opinions of the advertisers, sponsors, the management, or the staff of this radio network or of this local radio station. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law Hour and editorial review, then please go to our website at georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. O-R-G, or call us direct at 417-273-4967. All right, we're talking about insurance is a crime. It's a crime that violates the Ten Commandments. It violates the 759 statutes, judgments, and commandments that God gave us out at Mount Sinai. Now, Jesus told us, he said, you know, you people ought to live by every word that proceeds out of the mouth of God. Well, that's what he said. That's his opinion of it. But, of course, you and I, you know, we got our own views on whether or not we ought to or how much of it we ought to. And so we deal in insurance, which is strictly prohibited. It comes under what we call the negligent statutes, of which there are several. But the key, the main negligent statute in the scripture is at Exodus 21, verses 28 through 36. Now, we're going over a story here. An old-timey buddy of mine, his name is Emil Crow. He's an older fellow. He's dead now. He's been dead for many years. But when I was a young pup, you know, out here in the business world, Emil was an old man. And one day, Emil brought me in, and he sat me down. He said, "Let me explain this to you." And so I'm now telling you the story that Emil explained to me. This is the way this game is played. And it came right from an insider. You know, boys and girls, if we want to know how this is played, we got to have one of the insiders that's playing the game explain it to us, because you're not going to figure this out on your own. So old Emil sat me down and said, "Okay, let me explain this to you." Now, the two lawyers sit down, and remember that the guy's lawyer that he hired now, he's going to get one-third of the proceeds. Now, he's been offered $7,000, and he's convinced that that's not enough. And he wants more than $7,000. He hires a lawyer. Now, the lawyer says, "I'll take your case on. I'll take it on contingency. But you got to pay me one-third of what I collect for you. I'm going to get you more than $7,000. That's unreasonable. That's unfair." Hell, everybody would, you know, anybody that listened to this, a jury, opposing counsel, Emil Crow knew that the $7,000 offer was unfair. But Emil Crow, now remember, is an entrepreneur. He's a businessman. You know, his job in life is to make as much money out of this transaction as he can. And his job is to represent the Travelers Insurance Company. Nothing more, nothing less. Nothing personal. And the way he gets paid, the way the system pays him, he gets paid a percentage of whatever he saves the company. So his job is to settle this claim for as few dollars as is possible. He would settle this claim for a dollar, another good and valuable consideration, if he could. He would settle this case for nothing, no dollars at all. Just we're sorry as hell and have a good day, if he could. If he has to, if there's no other way around it, and we're absolutely forced to, and we don't have any other options, we'll pay the whole $50,000. But we're not going to do it voluntarily. We're going to fight, and we're going to kick, and we're going to scratch, and we're going to do everything we can to pay you nothing while you fight and kick and scratch and do everything you can to make us pay every damn dollar. This is an adversarial proceeding. It has nothing to do with justice. This is not a justice issue here. This is just business. And so a part of the modality that the insurance company uses is to pay their man, their front man, their knight riding on their horse, is to pay him a percentage, 50% of whatever you save. If you could save us the whole $50,000, we'll pay you $25,000 to do that. If you save us $10,000, you get $5,000. All right, so that's the name of the game. Now, the lawyer working for this guy that's damaged over here, his job is to get as much as possible. As much as possible. Now, I'm going to emphasize as much as possible. That doesn't mean the whole $50,000. It means he's there to get as much as is possible to get for both his client and himself. And he gets paid a percentage. He gets paid one-third of whatever it is he collects from the insurance company. All right. Now, Emil isn't going to tell him that we're playing for $50,000. If the guy knew he was playing for $50,000, then he knows what the policy limit is. He knows what the game is, what the parameters of the game is. So Emil tells him that the game, the parameters are $20,000, which is good. That's really good. See, most insurance policies in 1950 are going to top out at around $10,000. It'd be $5,000 to $10,000. This is an extra ordinary policy. It tops out at $20,000. What nobody knows except Amil and the insurance company is that, ooh, you boys really scored big. If you only knew how big you scored, you got a $50,000 policy here, but we ain't going to tell you how much you're playing for. And we don't have to. See, the insurance companies used to have to, and then they went into the legislature and they got legislation passed to protect the policy limit. So you can't know how much you're playing for. We know how much you're playing for, but you don't. How do you like that for fair, huh? Again, boys and girls, we're not playing fair. This is business. Business, nothing personal. So, in order for Amil to get paid anything at all on this deal, the settlement has to be something under $20,000. So Amil and this guy's attorney sit down, and Amil says, I get paid 50% of what I save the company, and I want $1,500 to settle this claim. And if you don't give me the $1,500, then we're going to scream like gutshot banshees that there's contributory negligence. And a certain percent of the time, we're going to win, and your client's going to get paid something less than he thinks he's entitled to. So, maybe you can get the whole $20,000 out of us, or maybe you can't. So, I'll tell you what we'll do. I'll come off my $7,000 nuisance value settlement number, and I will recommend that we settle the case for $17,000. That'll leave $3,000 in the pot. I'll get $1,500. The company gets $1,500. Now, most any insurance agent, most any insurance adjuster, most any lawyer would know that insurance adjusters get paid a percentage of what they save the company. And so the opposing counsel looks at that and says, you know, it's a pretty fair offer. $20,000 is a big policy, and you got a big policy, so we're playing for $20,000. So he goes back to his client, and he recommends that he accept $17,000. And his client says, but my bills are going to total $50,000. Well, the guy's got $20,000 worth of insurance, and we can get $17,000 of it. We can't get the whole $20,000 without litigation. Now, if we go to litigation, we suffer the potential of losing. And we got a good case, and we think we can win, and he's got a $20,000 policy, and they'll come off that $7,000. See, the reason for offering this $7,000 is to make this guy mad, to make him think that we've got a policy over here of about $10,000, certainly not over $20,000. That's to keep your expectations low. Makes you mad as hell, and you'll go out and hire a lawyer. And now you got two sharks deciding what they're going to do with you. You've decided that you're legally incompetent. You can't negotiate for yourself. Now, you can sue this guy independently of the insurance company. After you've made this insurance settlement, you can sue this guy for the deficiency if you want to. That's your option. But, your lawyer over here says you better take the $17,000 while you can. So the guy says, well, okay, I guess I better do that because you're recommending it and you're my lawyer. And so here's the way the deal came down. $17,000 is the number. Now, they think they're playing for 17 out of 20. They never did find out that they were playing for 17 out of 50. And so $33,000 was left on the table. So Amil Crow gets $16,500, doesn't he? The insurance company saves $16,500, which leaves $17,000. Now, the guy that's representing this guy, the lawyer, he gets a third of the $17,000. So let's take $17,000 here times 0.333, and we get $5,661. So the lawyer gets $5,600, and this guy gets the difference, about $11,000, $12,000. Which is, almost double what he was offered. Now, the reason the insurance company does this, first of all, you're in the hospital, you're not working, your car's destroyed, and the bank is calling you every day telling you to make your house payments. You haven't been working, you haven't got the money. So our objective is to put as much financial stress on you as possible so that you so that you're in over your head. You've got to make these payments. And so our objective over here is to put you under financial stress so that you'll accept our offer. Now, is that the way you thought insurance was supposed to work? That's not what you learned in school, now, was it? They taught you about about insurance and about how wonderful it was and how all these people are paying this money in. And we know that not everybody is going to make a claim. And then when there's a claim made, there's money there to make you whole. Isn't that sweet? God, sounds like it came from Big Bird or Mr. Rogers now, doesn't it? And if that's the way the game was played, maybe you'd have a point. But boys and girls, that's not the way the game is played. So when God told you not to screw around with insurance, he wasn't whistling Dixie now through a straw hat. He gave you straight from the shoulder good advice. And in fact, if you're self-insured, you can make the kind of money the insurance industry makes. Because the chances of you having that claim are very, very low. Remember I told you here on program number one, let me reiterate it again. You buy insurance on your automobile, and then what's your chances of collecting on that insurance? And the answer is, once every 32 or 3 years, you can expect to have an auto accident, and you're expected to pay out $1,835. Now, that's a few years back, but your insurance premiums at that time were $800 a year times 32 years. So if you paid in for 32 times $800, you'd pay in $25,600. $25,600. And out of $25,600, you would collect $1,835. I'll plug that in. That means the insurance company over the average auto insurance lifetime between accidents would collect $23,765. So the insurance industry makes $24,000 and pays out $2,000. How's that for a plan? Well, why don't you save the $24,000, and then when you have an accident, why don't you pay out the $2,000, and why don't you pocket the difference, which is $24,000? Huh? And that's called self-insurance. Now, they're self-insured. Now, most big cities, you know, like Tulsa, Oklahoma, they're self-insured. Hell, they know that the premiums they pay out, they don't pay out that much, you know, in actual claims. And so they defend themselves and they pocket the difference. Smaller entities buy insurance. And little people like us, we buy insurance, and especially when we're compelled to. Now, there's other ways for you to insure your automobile. You can do this with a property bond. Why don't you look at your state statutes over here? What else can we do besides insurance? The property bond doesn't violate the law of God. The insurance does. Tuck it away in your heart. All right, now that gives you a little understanding about how this game is being played. Now, there was a restaurant up in Ketchikan, Alaska. I'll tell you this little story over here. Ketchikan, Alaska. A guy's got a restaurant up there, and he has a fire. Fire burns the restaurant down. Now, it happens that Lloyd's of London has the insurance liability on this case up there, so Lloyd's comes out. Now, here's a little ditty for you. Lloyd's of London does not report a casualty loss under $100 million. That's right, $100 million. If they have a casualty loss of $50 million, they don't even report it. If they lose $100 million, $200, $500 million, a billion, they'll report that, but not under $100 million. Isn't that special? I mean, that's how big that outfit is. And they insure the big ticket items, you know. They insure ships like the Torrey Canyon and multi-billion dollar deals, you know. They're big time operators. Well, this little restaurant up there, for some reason, they've got the insurance policy, you know, and it's only a quarter of a million, $250,000 damage. The restaurant's totaled out. Now, for some reason, the insurance claims adjuster, I don't know, the guy walks in, he should have said, hey, we owe you the $250, and just wrote the check and paid him off. But for some reason, the insurance adjuster comes in. This isn't Lloyd's in London now. Hell, they're not even, the average executive probably over in London couldn't find Ketchikan, Alaska on a map with both hands at high noon. You know, he doesn't know. It's only $250,000. But the insurance claims adjuster, for whatever reason, whatever motivation, comes back and makes a report and says, hey, we think this is arson. We think that the building was burned on purpose. And so they look into this restaurant owner's past. They look into his business and his business accounts and his debts and one thing and another. And probably the guy has some debt. And so the insurance adjuster makes a case against him and says, hey, this guy burned his own restaurant down so he could collect the insurance money because he's short of money, short of funds, and he's having a bad business. So they look at your business and see how much it's doing. Is it dropping off? Are you making money? Are you losing money? And so if they can see that you're losing money and your restaurant burns down, immediately they say, hey, this guy burned his own restaurant down. Well, that's what they did. Now, not only don't you get paid for your restaurant burning down, now they bring criminal charges against you and charge you with arson. Now they're going to put you in prison. Not only isn't the insurance company going to pay you and make you whole, now they're going to prosecute you and put you in prison for making your claim. You pay your premiums and go to jail. How do you like that one? So this guy that owns the restaurant over there, I don't know what the exact details are. I don't know if it was a pro se case or he hired a lawyer or whatever. But he goes in and he successfully defends himself against the arson. Then he comes back against Lloyd's and he sues him. I don't know, he sued him for $2-3 million, something on that order. And Lloyd's dug in their heels. Now, you know, if the guy wins his case, Lloyd's should have come back and said, hey, let's back off of this and pay this guy off and get him behind us. They don't. They dug in their heels, and they fight this guy tooth and tongue. This case goes all the way up to the Supreme Court. And the Supreme Court sees that this is a bad faith case. Bad faith. Now, this is one of those kind of cases that comes down where you can all go home and smile and say, by God, they got what was coming to them. Now, the guy didn't sue for $100 million, but the court awarded him $100 million. How do you like that? Now, that doesn't happen very often, but when there's an exceptionally egregious case, I mean when there's a case that comes down where the insurance company is screwing people over and they're doing it on purpose and they know they're doing it and they do it with premeditated forethought. It's a part of their company policy to screw people over, like Haslett versus Pacific Mutual Indemnity. And Sears Roebuck did this to a guy one time with an invention. This guy had an invention. He's the guy that invented the ratchet with the push button in the middle to get the socket off. And I don't remember the exact numbers on it, but I'll give you some numbers here kind of off the top of my head. This guy made this invention, and somehow or another Sears got into the mix, and he sold it to Sears or something came down. And anyway, Sears owed him $20 million. And when the case got to litigation, Sears wouldn't pay him the $20 million that they legitimately owed him. And so he sued him for the money. And, you know, these cases typically take a long time. And when you've got a case that goes into appellate review, it's 3 years. So, you know, to get your case to trial can take you 2 or 3 years, especially if you're in federal court. I mean, I've done civil rights case. I did a civil rights case one time, took 5 years to complete the litigation on. And there's another case that's recorded, a civil rights case, came out of the 1968 Democratic Convention, where the victims of the Chicago police sued, and it took 11 years. And it was actually settled out of court, but it was 11 years in the litigation process. So the long time that it takes to litigate, most people will give up and quit. They won't stay in the game for 5 years or 11 years. You people haven't got that kind of patience. You people can't stay in a war like Vietnam for as long as it takes to win. Americans don't have what it takes to stick with it and win. You get tired after a couple of 3 years. You got to give up and go do something else. You lose interest. And the same thing is true. And the insurance companies know that. Hell, the insurance companies are going to be here this year, next year. Lloyd's of London's been around for hundreds of years. They expect to be around for hundreds of years to come. They're not. They got all the patience in the world. And so they go to the legislatures to get laws and rules passed so that these litigations take forever. Well, not forever, but, you know, close to it. We want to drag this out until you finally get so damn tired. Down on the Gulf Coast, many, many of those policyholders down there had good cases against their insurance companies and could have fought it and could have won every damn dime, plus, like this guy here does. This guy sued for the $20 million. And he won. Sears dug in their heels. The case goes to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court awarded him double that, $40 million. How do you like that? And down on the Gulf Coast, you know, a lot of those guys down there, they'd have a $300,000-$500,000 policy, and they suffered the damage, and by God, they were entitled to their money. But the claims adjuster comes in, and he offers them half that. And then pretty soon he comes up a little bit, and they're arguing and fighting, and pretty soon the policy holder, he just can't stand it anymore. He can't wait anymore. So he settles for half or two-thirds of the policy limit. And the insurance company walks off with the difference. The insurance company should have paid the full policy amount, and they walk off with a dollar less. That's a dollar of profit in their pocket. And they will hold your feet to the fire, boys and girls. They will not pay you. I did a case one time in which they strung the case out and strung the case out and strung the case out. Let me show you how that works. They don't pay you right away. And that's because of what we call the average daily balance. The insurance company owes you $5,000. Okay? But they don't pay you. And they don't pay you. And then pretty soon they send you a letter and say, you got to come in and file your claim over again. And then another month or two goes by. Another month or two goes by. You need to understand something here. They've got your $5,000, and your $5,000 is making them 10%. That's the number that they're using. 10% of $5,000. That's $500 a year. And if they pay you today, then they're not making that $500 a year. If they can stall you off for 365 days, they make $500. That's why they don't pay you right away. That's why it takes so long for you people to get your money. Doctors complain about the insurance company. They don't pay me. It takes them 90 days to pay me. Of course it takes them 90 days to pay. It's because they figure their interest rate on a daily basis. So they take 365 days and divide that into $500. So take 500 divided by 365 days, and that's $1.36 a day. Every day that they don't pay you that $5,000, they make $1.36. And you say, well, what in the hell is that all about? Very simple. They've got thousands of cases like that that amounts to millions of dollars a day. Every day that they don't pay you thousands of people out there, they're making thousands of dollars a day. And all of that's pure profit. That's why they do that. Again, nothing personal. It's just business. Well, I'm out of time here, boys and girls. We'll have to take it up right there next time. So let me remind you that you've been listening to The Law Hour, an editorial review sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri. Now, The Law Hour is heard 7 days a week here in the United States. And we're heard around the world in more than 120 countries daily over the Internet and radio. Now, if you'd like more information about the Law School and the Law Hour, please go to our website. That's georgegordon.org, georgegordon.org. The Law School is a private, non-commercial, non-profit, non-sectarian law school that is open to individuals but by prearrangement. The Law School conducts a homeschooling program for adults and compact disc. And the Law Hour website is updated weekly and has a radio log schedule and archives, all of which can be accessed through our website at georgegordon.org. georgegordon.org. That's georgegordon.org. Now, the Law Hour is an educational service brought to you in the public interest. Hey, our time's up. We've got to leave it right there. We'll see you back here tomorrow night. Same time, same station. God willing, of course. So until then, thanks for listening, everybody, and good night.